So last time I gave a brief overview over the Julia language and the syntax and the constructs. And today I want to make sure that you're all able to run Julia yourself on the laptop. So the first half of the lecture, or all of the lecture, depending on how long it takes, will be rather busy for you because you're going to install Julia on your laptop. I suggest you go to the Julia webpage, the Julia programming language, and then you click the big download button that leads you to this page, and then you download the respective package that you install. If you're using Windows or Mac, then it's quite clear what you do. If you're using a Linux laptop, then you might be tempted to use the respective package manager, Ubuntu or something, to install Julia. I recommend against that, because these package managers have their own idea of what version of Julia you should be using, and so do I. I think it should be version 1.0, so I recommend that you choose the downloadable version here, the generic Linux binary, or you build and install from source if you want to do that, but you probably can't do that in the lecture. That might be take a bit longer. So I recommend that you download and install something, and then we'll see how long it takes, and when most of you are done, then we are going to switch to something more interactive where you can run simple examples in Julia, define a type, add the numbers from 1 to 10, draw a circle on the screen or something like that. But first, I'd like to install Julia. I'm going to need feedback from you. So who has already installed Julia and run it? That's almost everybody, but that just means I'm sorry for you, because this lecture today is for the beginners, for those who have not yet installed Julia. So please go ahead and let me know if there are any problems. And I will probably walk around between the rows, and maybe one of you can help me with that to make sure that everybody's in the right track installing Julia. Okay, quick feedback for me, please. Who is still installing Julia? You're basically all done. Very good. So I gave a course teaching Julia 2 or 3 years ago, and after 2 hours, still half the class hadn't finished installing everything. It was absolutely horrible. I was so disappointed. And this, you here, apparently very different. So okay, we are done with today's class. So let's move on with the next material. Instead of just installing Julia, Julia has packages, add-on packages. You might know it from Python, where you can add additional packages, for example, NumPy or for plotting. But for Julia, similar packages exist. I want to briefly demonstrate how to use the Julia package manager. And this is one of the things that changed dramatically between previous versions and 1.0. In 1.0, it is much easier. So I opened my Julia command line. Can you all see the screen? The letters were large enough last time, so I guess it's still large enough. Good. Now, if you press the closing square bracket key, then you see that the prompt changes from green to something blue. So it's this key that you're pressing, the closing square bracket, and then it changes to blue. If you press backspace or delete, it goes back to green. And if you're blue, then you're in the package manager, and the first thing that you would type is, for example, update. And that should update all the packages that you have installed. You probably have not installed any packages. Then it downloads the list, the curated list of all the packages. And yeah, I have one package already installed called revise. You probably have no packages installed. Does this all work for you? It might take a bit longer for you, 30 seconds, because you're downloading the package index for the first time. And then let's add a particular package. A very useful package is plots. Plots is for plotting. So I'm going to do that. The command for that is add plots. There's, of course, also a help if you type help or question mark. And this is not Julia that you're typing here. It's just like shell commands with the package manager. So add plots. Plots with uppercase P will add the plots package. And since I already had plots installed for a different kind of Julia, it's much faster. For you, it will probably take a minute or something downloading things. And I also, yeah. So let me know once this is done for you. And this plot package depends on other packages. And this is all the green thing here that you might not be able to see. There's something about memory map show off. I don't know, cool package name. Measures, JSON, GR, fixed point numbers, and so on. It's all used by the plots package. So who's finished installing the plots package? Few of you? Who is still working on it? Most of you? Okay, let's wait a bit.
Can you see?
And after the plots package is installed, we can show something on the screen. And plotting is always a bit difficult because the exact commands that you need to use on an operating system to plot something depends on the operating system. Each operating system, Linux, Windows, Mac, or something, defines two or three different ways to create a window and to put pixels into the window. And correspondingly, the plots package has different backends, and you can choose different backends. There are three widely used backends, and if one of them doesn't use, if you don't like how the windows look, you can use the other one. The one that is used by default is called GR. Cool name, unfortunately, it has nothing to do with general relativity. It's just a cross-platform thingy written in C, and if you install the GR package, actually Julia will go by itself, download that package and install it in such a way that it doesn't interfere with any other software to have installed. And another interesting package is called Plotly. Plotly is based on JavaScript. And JavaScript is also supported on basically every computer because the browser has a compiler for JavaScript built in. So if you plot something with Plotly, then the web browser will open and show you the graph in there. And the third package that often works is matplotlib from Python. So Julia can import Python libraries and then use those for plotting. That works as well. So, who is still working on installing plots? 1, 2, 3. Okay, let's give it another 30 seconds. And then I'm going to, why don't we move ahead? I mean, it's not complicated what we're doing now. The next thing would be to use the plots package. So you press backspace, you're back on the Julia prompt then. And then you type using plots. Don't forget the uppercase P. And then again, for me, because I did that ahead of time, it's rather fast. Okay, it isn't fast. And for you, it's probably also slow. The first time Julia uses a package, it is likely to pre-compile the package. It takes a bit longer, but it compiles it and remembers the compiled code in the cache. And then when you use it the next time, or when you run it, it will be much faster. And then the plot command that you type is plot. So random 5,5 gives you a random matrix, 5x5 matrix, with, I guess, numbers between 0 and 1. And Julia will plot this. And line width equal 2. You can set the line width. Title equals my very first plot. You can use the title only once. Actually, I can't use it anymore, but you can use it. And then something should appear on my screen. The first time you do something, Julia, it takes longer. Later on, it will be faster. I'll try to stop the jokes now. This is the GR package, and you see 5 lines there. And because the 5x5 array has been interpreted as 5 data sets that are plotted, essentially random numbers. Let's change that then. Let's just call it my plot. And this is this one here. Yes?
You just said you can only use a title.
No, forget it. That was very tiny. Yeah. Apologies. And if you plot it again, of course, the lines will change because it will create a different set of random numbers in the plot command. Who is still working on this? Okay. What is currently happening for you? Are you still downloading the, is it still installing the plots package?
Yeah, I know.
Okay, in the meantime, I want you to point you to a web page. The Julia package, Julia has so-called communities. So if you type Julia plotting into a browser, then there's a web page, plotting in Julia, and this gives a brief introduction how to do plotting in Julia, and you get more information. There are other plotting packages as well. Instead of plots, what I'm showing you, there is another one called Gadfly that's also interesting that you can also use. I'm not going to show it to you, but you might be interested as well. What I showed you at the moment is the GR backend, where the output appears in a window like this up here. You can also use a different plot end, the Plotly backend. Let me change that. The the command is plotly. The plotly command is provided by the plots package. It will switch over to the plotly backend. And if you run a plotting command then, it opens the web browser, and in that web browser, it runs the corresponding JavaScript code that produces the plot. And apart from that, it of course looks very similar to the GR backend. So depending on which you prefer, GR or Plotly, but depending on which one works on your computer or not, you can use ISOP. Yes.
Whenever you restart Julia and want to plot again, do you always have to type using plots?
Or? Yes. Yes. So installing packages or uninstalling packages, that is remembered. But whenever you have a session, in the beginning of the session, you need to say what packages you want to use. And now at the moment, what we're doing here on the shell, this is all interactive. Every time you start, you need to start from scratch. That is, of course, inconvenient. Later today, I want to show you how you can put Julia code into a file, and then this file contains near the top using plots, and then you, of course, everything is remembered. Yes?
How do you go back to GR from Plotly?
Yes, you type GR. And yeah, right, that should have been GR. It's lowercase GR, I can never remember. And then if you plot, you might have seen the other thing changes. And there's another backend, matplotlib or pyplot or something, you can switch to that as well. So this plots package in Julia, it's just kind of a meta package. It doesn't really provide any plotting commands. It just provides a uniform interface that allows you to use any sorts of plotting packages. But in your code, you don't really have to choose what plotting package you use. And of course, I mean, I don't want to give you an introduction to plotting today. Today is about installing Julia and doing your first steps. But you can save plots in various file formats, PDF, SVG, and so on. And if you want to learn about that ahead of time, you can go to the Julia plotting web page that I pointed you. And I forgot to mention something last time. I recommended YouTube. So this is YouTube. And I looked for JuliaCon 2018. Let me make it a bit larger. And various movies, recorded talks from the JuliaCon conference that happened about a month ago with various introductions. Some people give more or less scientific presentations of work they did using Julia, or computer science presentations of work for Julia, but there are also introductory talks, for example, how to get started with the Julia Package Manager, or different notation for for loops, Einstein sum convention, and so on. Various packages and various work about Julia is introduced here. So if you're interested, you could look at one of these talks. Okay. Last time, I gave you a brief overview of how to program with Julia. And now I want to take about 10 or 15 minutes for you to repeat these things. And something that you could do is, for example, sum up the numbers from 1 to 10. Do you remember that? Of course, you can type 1 plus 2 plus 3, but this gets tedious quite quickly. So Julia has the notion of ranges. If you type 1 colon 10, that is the range that goes from 1 to 10. By default, it takes a step size of 1, so that's all integers. So this is output as a range. And the command to sum over a collection of numbers is just sum. So if you sum over this, let's see where that works. Yes, the sum is 55. If you just look at the range 1 to 10, then the range is just brought back to you. But you can also, what is called collect. Collect expands the range, or expands any iterator, into an array of numbers. So if you type collect, then you get a 10 element array with the numbers from 1 to 10. And of course, you could also sum these up. Now, if you do it with the numbers of 1 to a million, then, of course, representing the range from 1 to a million as a range is more efficient, because you just need to remember start and end instead of expanding it into a large array. And the sum function or other functions, most functions know how to deal with this abstract representation, not just with arrays. So that is then more efficient. I want to remind you of how to define a function. If you assign a value to a variable, just x equals 2, for example. If you define a function, then you would write f of x equals, I don't know, x squared minus 1 divided by 2. This is now a function that is defined. F of 1 is 1. F of minus 1 is what? No. Is that right? I'm confused. Yes, of course. I'm sorry. And f of 0 is minus 1 half. I shouldn't use complicated functions like this. And this you might recall from Python, if you know Python. The special thing about Julia that I mentioned last time is that Julia has a stricter support for types. So let's define a new function, but this new function should only accept integers. So g of x int equals x plus 1. And now if I call g of 42, the result will be 43, quite boring. If I call g of 42.5, then the result will be an error, because the function g is not defined. In Julia's notion, each function has several methods, and there is no method that handles the floating point type. You can define that as well. If you write g of float 64 equals x divided by 2, and now we have one function g that has two methods. We can look at the methods of g. There's one for float 64 and one for integer. And if we call g with the 42.5, now the result will be calculated. And the advantage that these methods have is if you take, for example, linear algebra, the expensive operations in linear algebra have to do with matrices. And if you're familiar with numerical linear algebra, you will know that matrices have many different representations. There's, of course, dense matrices. They can be symmetric, Hermitian. They can be sparse, banded, tridiagonal, and so on. And in Julia, it makes sense to define different types for these different matrix representations. And then if you call a particular operation, for example, solve a system, then there are different solve routines for different matrix representations. And when you handle a particular matrix, you never need to know whether the matrix is tridiagonal or linear or symmetric or whatnot. You just call solve, and the type that the matrix has will automatically select a particular routine that makes it efficient to write, it makes it simple to write efficient code that handles many different matrix representations. And if you call a routine, for example, add two matrices, add a sparse matrix and a tridiagonal matrix, then Julia will internally know how to handle that. And if you're interested in linear algebra, there's, of course, a part of the Julia tutorial of the Julia documentation that points you to this.
So if I ask g of 2?
I defined g to be of x to be x plus 1.
Oh, for the what's the other one? Not to the g float.
Yes, so there are two methods. These are two different definitions. They don't override each other. They exist side by side, and there are two methods, and that they have been, well, combined for the function g. And you can add additional methods, and you can also write a fallback method. For example, you can write g of x without specifying a type equals whatever, something like this. And if you don't write a type annotation, you can also give it a type any. Any is the type that captures everything. And if you now look at the methods, then there are three different methods, and Julia will use the most specific methods That is, if I pass an integer, it will use the integer, but if I pass a string, then neither integer nor float matches, and it will use the generic method. Hello? No, uses that method. I also showed you last time how to define a type in Julia, and this is something that is in that way not possible in Python. In Python, Python has classes, but defining a class in Python is rather different from defining a type in Julia. So I'm going to repeat that, and I'm trying to find the right speed so that you can move along. Let me define a type point. The command for that is struct similar to C, and I call it point. And a point has two values, an x value, I say it needs to be an integer, and a y value, it needs to be an integer, and n. And then I can create the point like a function call that calls a constructor, and this is now a point where x and y have the values 1 and 2 correspondingly, similar to what we in C. Let me assign that to the variable p, and then p.x is 1, and p.y is 2. And as expected, if you call point with 1.5 as argument, there's an error. And Julia shows you the two constructors that exist and both accept two arguments. 2.5 also does not work because I'm trying to construct a point from floating point numbers, but x and y have been declared to only accept integers, so this does not match either. Are you all familiar with, does this all make sense to you? If you know C or Fortran, the languages, that makes that it's basically the same thing there. Now, Julia also allows you what is called parameterized types that looks, well, let me show you an example first. Struct, call it point 2, sorry, running out of names here. And in curly braces, T, that means a point. And T is a particular type, and then I say it has X, component X of type T, sorry, a field Y of type T. And this is now a type that can hold values of any type T, but you need to choose what type T it is. So I can, for example, say point 2 of int of 1 and 2, and then get a point of integers. I can say point of floating point numbers, and then the 1 and 2 will be converted to floating point numbers. And I can, since anything works, I can also put characters in there, and for example A and B, and now point holding characters. And of course it doesn't make sense, points and characters and so on. And you can also take this recursively. You can put points into points if you want. You can put arrays into points. You can put arbitrary things into points. Here, when I call the constructor, I use the curly brace to say what type I want. You don't actually have to do that. You can just write point 2 of 1 and 2. And then Julia will deduce that this should be an integer point because I passed two integer values in here. And the beauty of this generic definition, this parameterized definition, where there's a type T, is that on one hand, you can put anything into the point. Yes?
Sorry. So structure, you can't rename a structure again. So what's the version that you can rename again? So if I try and just define struct...
Oh, yes. I was going to talk about that later. But if you create a point object, then this object is immutable. You cannot make any changes. You can create a mutable struct, the mutable space struct, and then you can change it again. And I briefly mentioned this last time on Wednesday, when there were arrays and we assigned arrays, there was a definition difference between two equal signs and three equal signs. And if it's the first time you heard that, it might have been a bit confusing. I said that's where software engineering, mathematics diverge. Because in mathematics, if X is something, then it just is that and you cannot change it later. And immutable struct, the one we defined here, has these beautiful mathematical properties that make it easy to write correct code. But sometimes, for efficiency, you want to be able to change something, and then you need to define a mutable struct. And when I program, my default is to go for struct first, the immutable ones, the elegant ones, but sometimes you need to change something. I'm going to come to that later. Right now, I want to talk about parameterized types. So the beauty of such a parameterized definition is that on one hand, you can put everything into a point, but on the other hand, when you create a point, you choose what types you put in there, and that means the compiler knows that as well, that the language knows that as well, and that has a very efficient internal representation. If you define a point that can hold arbitrary values, then every time you use such a point, the compiler needs to check what type it is and needs to dispatch something, and that leads to inefficient code that runs about 10 times slower. Here, if you call a point like that, if you define a point like this, it's immediately clear that this point holds integers that is decided at compile time, and at runtime, the values will be stored efficiently, maybe even in a register, and it runs at full speed, the same speed that you would get in C or C++, because there's no runtime overhead. Let me define, for comparison, the point 3 type that can also hold arbitrary values. Struct point 3, x, y, and. So we made no type annotation here. That means you can put anything into point 3, and then you can also write point 3, 1, and 2. And it also holds integers. But the difference is, if you have a point 2 of int 64, if you know this is the type, then you know immediately the two fields contain integer values. That is very efficient. And here, if there's a point 3, then it's not clear what types the values have. So the code also needs to store what is called a type tag, and at runtime, the code needs to look up what type is stored, and then finds out it's an integer, and then needs to do corresponding dispatch. I see myself not making a very good explanation, apologies, but the difference is that this parameterized type up here is sufficiently, significantly more efficient, and it's one of the things that make Julia more efficient than similar languages that are similar, easy to program, for example, MATLAB or Python. I hope I'm not being too good, too so far. Now I'm going to skip talking about abstract types and the type hierarchy here. I'm going to define a function that takes a point as input and does something with the point. For example, function add 2 points. There's a P, which is a point of type T, and Q, which is also a point of type T. And now I need to add this where T. This means this is a function add takes two arguments, P and Q. P and Q must be of type point of T. T can be arbitrary. That means it can be any type of point, but both P and Q need to be points of the same type, either point of integer or point of floating point number. I can also put a constraint onto T, T number, and that means P and Q can be points, but both points must have the same type T, and T must be a subtype of number, and then I can add them. Then I can write, for example, point P dot x plus Q dot x, P dot y plus Q dot y. No! Oh no, of course, it needs to be point 2, because I defined point to be the non-generic one. Oof. And this is what comes out. And defining functions like this is rather common in Julia. Parameterized functions, you still have the freedom to use any particular type of points. You can have points of integers, point of floating point numbers, point of complex numbers. The code you write is still completely generic, but the code you generated is quite efficient. I'm going to give you a minute to finish typing and thinking about this.
What does the smaller column, so t smaller column number, do again?
Oh, this means T must be a subtype of number. Julia has a type hierarchy, and there are even more generic types. And number was one of the very generic number types that Julia has. So any numeric types, integer, real numbers, complex numbers, I don't know, maybe even quaternions, would be a subtype of number. And essentially, if you define a type to be a numeric type, to be a subtype of number, you probably expect it to support addition, subtraction, multiplication, or something like this. I mean, Julia isn't very mathematical, but I think number is similar to what the ring would be in mathematics. I also want to show you how to look under the hood, how to see how Julia translates the code. There is this macro code typed that shows you the internal representation of a particular function. So this was the function that I just called, and the internal representation, I hope this is not too long, looks like this. Oh no, it's okay. You see how it looks internally? Base.getField is a function that takes an object and looks at a particular field of this object. So it takes the object P and looks at the field called X. It looks at Q and the field X, and then add int is integer addition of the variables %1 and %2 that were defined here. You see it's an internal representation. I don't expect you to understand that, but you see that the respective code is quite, it is not very complicated. There's also code native. It shows you the machine instructions to which the code compiles. And as you see, the respective machine instructions, they are not many. They are just actually, well, there's a move instruction that does something, another move instruction, and one add instruction. So if you add 2 points, you would expect 2 integer additions. But it turns out that this CPU and my laptop here has so-called vector instructions that can do multiple operations in one operation. And the code was automatically optimized. So this point add routine translates essentially to a single machine instruction. That's quite efficient. And this is what you would also see in the true high performance languages, Fortran, C, C++. I want to show you another way of writing the add function. Let me call it add2. Sorry, I'm running out of names here. Where remove all the annotations about the types T. And this does essentially the same thing. So now I require that P is a point 2 and Q, the same thing. But I don't specify any of these type parameters, type T. And that means any type T is OK. This is just a simpler way of writing the same thing. And the add2 function does the same thing. I can add 2 points, does the same thing. In hindsight, I should have shown you this function definition here first. It was much simpler to type, and you don't need this where syntax. Yes?
So I tried to add strings before. Is that possible with that function? Because it wasn't possible with just the normal.
Okay, yes, so strings don't really form a ring, so you shouldn't really call it addition. And in many languages, they still use the plus operation to concatenate strings. In Julia, in their wisdom, the authors decided strings need to be multiplied to be concatenated. So you write AB times CD, and you do this. And of course, you can also take a string to a particular power, and then you get this. So. One of the sources of efficiency of Julia is that once you define a type, you cannot, sorry, did you have a question? Okay. That you cannot redefine a type. So I defined a type point up there. If I try to redefine the type point, for example, what, x, n, int, or something, then this leads to an error message because the type point is already defined. And the other problem that we saw earlier is that every type, you start Julia again, you have to type using again if you want to start plots and so on. So it's rather, this interface here, this command line, this interactive shell, is quite convenient to explore things. But at some point, you're going to write larger programs, multiple functions, multiple methods, different type definitions. Maybe you made a small error that you just want to correct, and then having to retype everything is quite inconvenient. So of course, the real way to use Julia, which I was hiding from you until now, is that you have an editor open. In this editor, you write a file with Julia code, and in that command line, you just execute the corresponding file. And so what I want you to do now is to choose an editor of your choice. I myself use Emacs. Another good editor would be Atom or Sublime. And which editors exist and which are convenient depends also on the operating system that you're using. So it's different on macOS or on Linux or on Windows. I want you to choose an editor and install such an editor if you don't have it already installed. And then I can show you how to create a file with Julia, and then you can write larger programs and can modify them. So I learned this morning that Sublime is a good editor for Windows. I think Atom works as well. If you're not familiar with that, then maybe one of you with a Windows laptop could come forward and show on the screen how to download and install a Windows editor, or are you all already familiar with that? Okay, I get no feedback, so I'll just forge ahead. I will try to find my Emacs thingy here, create a new frame. Then, does somebody know how I make the font bigger here in this Emacs? Options. Set default font.
Is it like Emacs Atom or Jupyter Notebook?
So Jupyter Notebook is something else that's also convenient, but in a Jupyter Notebook, it's also difficult to create a file where you remember something. So at the moment, I recommend an editor such as Emacs or Sublime. Okay, I'm going to cheat here. I'm going to make everything bigger here. And then I'm going to make this one here smaller again. And maybe that works. So I'm going to, in this editor, I'm going to go to a new directory where there are no files yet. For example, this is what I'm using for the course. And then I created JL subdirectory. Why not call the JL? And then in the command line, I'm going to the same directory here. And this is where I'm going to write the Julia code. Are you familiar with terminals, shells, command line? If not, we can spend a few minutes to give you a crash course. No one speaks up. Do you want the crash course? Okay. So how did you start Julia so far? How did you start Julia at the moment? Is that Windows or what are you using? Windows. Oof. Good point. let's do it differently then. Let's just open Julia as it is, and let's see whether we can do it in Julia. Very good. So ignore what I did here with the red thing. You would choose a particular directory, a new directory that you create. So you can use the Windows Explorer for this. Is it still Windows Explorer on Windows 10? You would create a new directory, and then you find out where this directory is located, and then you type cd and the directory name. And the pwd command and shows you in which directory you are. Does this work for you? I'm sure there are some people here more versed in Windows, and the same sequence of commands, of course, also works on Mac and on Linux. And of course, your directory names look different, right? I mean, on Mac, all the users are stored in the directory /users. My username is ishnet. And of course, you can choose any directory name you want. You don't have to call it computational physics course. Okay. Are you all here? Did you create such a directory? Okay. One easy way to create the files and everything and run code is to create a Julia package. Earlier I showed you how to download and install the plots package, but you can also generate your own package and then have your own files in that package. And of course, later on, you can make a more fancy package, including test cases and everything. So to create a package, you go again to the package manager with the closing square bracket key. That was that key. And then you generate a particular package, and let's call it example. I'm going to call it example 2018. And then I'm going to go back to the regular Julia prompt and go into this example 2018 directory. And in my editor, you see that a new directory, example 2018, was created. This directory contains the Julia package. You can go in there, and there's a source directory. And in the source directory, there is a Julia file called example 2018.jl. And if you open it in your editor, Atom or Sublime, you should see a very simple Julia project. It's one Julia module called example 2018 that defines one function. The function is called greet and just prints something to the screen. Did you all generate such a package? I'm getting no feedback. Let's assume that works. I'm now going to activate that package. I know that the first time we do this, it's a bit complicated. The editor and shell generating package, activating it. Yes?
So for the directory, does it have to end in an editor file? Or because I'm getting...
Which directory? The CD up here? That needs to be a directory that you created. It should be an empty directory. It doesn't have to be. It can be your home directory if you want.
Because I'm always thinking an error. Invalid escape sequence.
Invalid, pardon?
Invalid escape sequence.
Oh, okay. Let me have a look at your screen then.
Using backslash. Can you just forward slash extension?
I think it's forward slash or two backslash. I just copied it.
Yes, I didn't think of that. Get something forward for just revert. PWD. Okay, very good. And now you see two backslashes okay. Because okay. It's okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay, the issue was here that under Windows, you use a backslash to separate the components of file names. Backslash is that character. In Unix, you use a forward slash, that's that character. And if you type a backslash into a Windows string, into a Julia string, then you need to use two backslashes. You need to double them. But you can also use a single forward slash instead. Just don't be confused about that.
How do I ask in Julia which directory I'm in?
This is PWD. That's the same command as in a shell. It says it's kind of called print working directory. So if I type PWD again, then I'm in a different directory than above here. This was the JL, and now I'm in a JL example 2018.
So it should have been created there.
Pardon?
When I type generate, it should have been created here.
Yeah, if you type generate and the name of a project, it generates a new Julia project with a particular name, and it generates a directory for that and a few files in that directory. And after generating an object, a particular project, now we want to work in that project, so we need to activate it. I don't like that I have to activate it and I have to do it every time I start Julia, but apparently that's necessary. So I go back into the package manager, and type activate, and then the dot, dot is the current directory, the current project, yeah. And then it's active. And then I can, for example, type using example 2018. And then I can call the respective functions in here. For example 2018 greet, and I see the hello world. I'm going to leave that on the screen a bit because this is it's a bit tedious to do that because obviously if you have a typo somewhere in the command, it doesn't work, and it's the first time you do this. So the last two commands I typed here are using example 2018. The problem is, if in a Julia shell you use the particular module, there is no way to unuse it. So if we now make a change to this module, example 2018 here, and try to using it again, this will not work. Instead, what we have to do is leave Julia, start Julia again, type the cd command, activate it again, and type using again. It's really tedious. It's clearly not the way to go. So I'll show you a better way to do that. And the better way to do that would be to create a test case for this module, and then you can rather easily run the test case interactively. So in the project directory, there was the source directory. Next to the source directory, I want you to create a directory called test. And in the test directory, I want you to create a file runtests.jl. And we can put the particular code in here. And then if you have created this file and type test and hold your breath, then it will output hello world. What it does, it runs all the test cases for the module, it runs all the code in the run tests, and you can do this as many times as you want. And if you now change the module and run tests again, then you can do that without leaving the Julia shell. Now the instructions I just gave were a bit complicated, so let's repeat. In the same directory where the source directory was generated, when you generated the package, you create a new subdirectory called test that is visible up here. And if you're not familiar with creating a directory, then that is something that you probably need to learn. And if you want to do computational science, you can use the Windows Explorer for that, or you can use the terminal or the command line. Do you all know how to create a directory in a particular location? Have you created the test directory? Okay, so it seems some of the technical details did provide stumbling blocks. Sorry about that, or good that we talked about that, I guess. Now let's extend the project. Let's add something else here. So I'm now in this, using an editor, I'm going into the source directory. There's this example 2018 file where the function greet was defined. Of course, we don't care about that. Let's remove it. And let's instead put one of the type definitions in here and repeat what we did earlier. For example, struct point t and x struct t. Y is of type T, and then if you use a module, then you can, if you want to make something, functions or types or something available from a module, then it's nice to export certain identifiers from a module. Then you don't have to write example 2018 dot point, you can write just point. So let's export point. And let's write an add function, that we can add points, but I don't want to write an add function. I want to use the plus operator. And the way to do that is to add a new method to the plus operator. And you need to have a space after the dot and the plus operator for various reasons. And how does it work? Point p dot x plus q dot x, p dot y plus q dot y. And let's change the test case. We have the greet, we don't want that. Instead, we just add show, print something to the screen. We write point 1, 2 plus point 3, 4. And then let's rerun the test case.
Can you make the text in the editor a bit bigger?
Oh, of course. The thing is, it gets bigger, but it's... Does that help?
Yeah.
I don't know how to change... Yeah, okay. Can you still read the bottom? Oof. I'm still rearranging the screen a little bit. So in Julia, function names cannot just be names like add or subtract, but operators are also function names. So for example, the sign plus, that is a function.
There's a blank.
Yes, yes. And what we're doing is we are adding a particular method to the plus operator. We don't want to override the existing one. And this plus operator is defined in base. Base is the basic library of Julia, where all the basic things that are always available are defined. So base.plus, by adding a method to this operator, we are extending the existing addition operator in Julia. And this base is necessary for a very particular reason. I don't want to go into too much detail, but you might remember what I said about broadcasting. If not, I'll just repeat it. Can you see the bottom of the screen there? No one complains. If you have an array, 1, 2, 3, and you want to multiply it with another array, 4, 5, 6, this doesn't work because it's not clear. If you put a dot in front of an operator, then the operation is pointwise. So if I write base dot plus, then Julia interprets it as something base, and then pointwise with something in these parentheses. And this completely doesn't make sense because it has nothing to do with the function definition. And therefore, if you add the space in here, then Julia knows it's not this broadcasting syntax that you do something with arrays, but rather, well, then it's interpreted as a function definition, as a method definition with the base dot prefix, because the plus operator was originally defined in base. Yes, if I remove the space here and run test, then I should get an error message. What does it say? Load error, syntax, and... No, that's not the error.
Oh, I got a space between the plus and the...
Oh, that's another thing, yes. The beginning parenthesis of a function, Julia does not want spaces in front of it. It turns out if you allow this, then people make subtle mistakes and Julia misinterprets that. And this leads to errors that are difficult to diagnose. And just to prevent these kind of errors, then Julia grammar now disallows spaces in front of opening parentheses for function definitions. So if you have a space here, that would be a syntax error. Pardon? Oh, cool. Very good. Yes. It's better to get an error than if it doesn't work silently.
Okay, you didn't export point. I have export point to make it exported from the module. That means if you export it from the module and later use the module with using, then it's visible. If you don't export it, oh, it's one line export point.
Yes, Julia has macros, so if anything is not a proper function call or something, it's probably a macro, and then it is an at sign in front of it to warn people. So it's at show. Because the show thing doesn't just calculate the points and output it, but it also takes what you wrote here and converts it into text and then shows it. Right? This is this text here. This is verbatim what you wrote here. And that's not something you could do with a function. This is why you need the at sign there.
And if we would have declared a variable and then
Yeah, if you write it like this, then it just says P.
And without the at?
Without the at, it doesn't work. There's no function show. Oh, it's a syntax error, because it's not even the proper syntax for a function call or anything. Well, there might be, but if you want to call a function show, you do write it like that with parentheses or not. And if you just write two things next to each other, then it's just a syntax error, because it's not a function call or anything. Yes?
To which level does export support this structure? Just the same level of directories or?
So, the directory, so once you're in Julia, then directories don't matter. What's happening here is there's a module, example 2018, and the point is hidden inside it. And export exports it from the module, then it's at the same level. So after you say using example 2018, you can just write point. And without the export, you would have to write example 2018 dot point, like with the greet that we had earlier.
Functions from different modules.
How do you, pardon?
Borrow functions from different functions from
You would be using that module usually. Yes, that's the usual way to do that. Okay, what should we do next? Subtract is boring, scale. Can we do something else with points? Calculate an area, integrate? Okay, did you all run this example? I had cheat sheet last time of things I wanted to go through. Of course, I didn't finish all of that. Let's see. Maybe we should rather. Actually, there was a question about the mutable structure earlier. So let's do that. We have a point, and let's define a mutable point. M point. I don't like long names. Yeah, now my screen isn't big enough to see all that, to show all that. So earlier, there was a question regarding structs and mutable structs. So when defining a new point, new data type here, sorry, up here is the point that we defined earlier. And now define a new type, a mutable struct. I call it M point, M for mutable. And apart from the mutable keyword here, it looks exactly the same as the point. And what this allows, it allows one to change an object that is defined. And here's an example for that. I define an endpoint, same as the point. I assign it to a variable 2. If you look at Q at this point here, this is the output. The value is 1.2, as expect. And then what I can do with the mutable thing, I can change it. I can say Q.x equals 9. Now it's the same object in memory, but it has obtained a different value. That's the thing that is not possible in mathematics with value semantics. And then if you output Q again, you see that it's 9,2 instead of 1,2.
Is it also possible to make an executable?
I think so. People have done it. There are companies that use Julia, and they, of course, want to produce executables to give it to a customer. I've never done it myself. Now, the Julia compiler is an executable. It is written in Julia. So, yes, it's possible, but it's probably not trivial. What you need to do is you need to define all the functions that should go into the executable. Of course, you can also cheat. You can just wrap up the compiler in all the functions, and then everything just looks like an executable from the outside. Okay. So today's lecture, or today's lab, is almost over. We have about 10 minutes left. I want to use the last 10 minutes for feedback or for questions from you. If your homework was to create a new package, a new Julia package, example 2019 or something else, would you feel comfortable doing that? I think this would be a good exercise to create something. What I usually do is whenever I have a new idea or I work on something, I create a new directory, I generate a new Julia package, and I do something in there. And of course, if the idea doesn't work out, then after 3 days, I completely ignore it and don't do anything with it anymore. So there's no point in always using the same Julia package, right? Creating a new Julia package is a rather quick thing to do. And in terms of computational science and proper behavior and then project management, of course, it's also important to keep backups of these Julia packages and make sure things don't get lost and so on. And we'll also talk about that in the upcoming labs and upcoming lectures. In particular, Julia packages should go to GitHub repositories. There should be test cases. There should be probably examples, a bit of documentation, and so on and so forth. But creating Julia packages is something that you'll continue to be doing if you continue to work with Julia. And some of you were not experienced in handling the command line in Julia and Windows. Unfortunately, the state of the art in computational science is that you're going to have to do that a lot. So if you're unsure how to do that, there are probably good tutorials on the web on how to do that, either for Windows or for Unix, to get more familiar with that and to be able to understand error messages if something goes wrong. In particular, if you want to run a larger calculation on a supercomputer somewhere that might also be interesting at some point, then it's all going to be command line like that, not anything different. Okay, so can you now ask a question or register a complaint with me if something goes wrong? Of course, you can also complain via email or something. You don't have to do it in public. Is there something you didn't understand?
So
something I should say again?
If you changed not the test, but the whatever the package itself, do you need to activate it again or something? Or?
No. So if you change the source code here that we look at in the editor, you don't have to activate it again. You only need to activate it if you start Julia again. So now I exited from the Julia command line here.
How did you actually exit?
I put Control D. You close the window or something. Control D works on the Mac OS and Linux. I don't know whether it works on the Windows. TXT.
So for me, it says that it's.
So I'm starting Julia again, sorry, and then I activate it again. And you see how it changes? If you just start Julia, it says version 1.0. It's just a generic Julia version. And then if I activate a project, then it has the project name here. And whenever you work on a project, you're supposed to activate it. And then I can also run the respective test case.
It seems when you change the files and try to do it again, usually the test doesn't really, it gives you an error. Like when I modify the files.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's not supposed to do that. So I can change the module. I mean, of course, if it uses a syntax error in there, then you have to fix the syntax error before it works. But restarting Julia should not be necessary, except if you crash it, right? I mean, that
it's just
I can do that. Pardon? What is it?
Endpoint not defined. Like
that. Maybe you didn't save it. You need to save it. Sometimes that's difficult to see. Yes.
I saved it. Yeah. I closed it, open again, it's still there. My changes.
And it says endpoint on. Oh, did you export endpoint?
I think so. There.
Okay. This is confusing. Okay. Let me see.
Right. So this is the file. It's definitely saved. And I tried to run the test. The first test is the class, so then it says.
Oh, it's a lowercase p.
Did you also make a typo, like me?
I hope not.
Yes, so I think the problem here seems to have been uppercase, lowercase p.
That's super funny. That we made the same.
You're sitting in the same row. Okay. Okay, you have more questions?
What's the difference of to make a module and to make a new project? It looks like the same.
So project is kind of how it looks from the outside. It's how it's managed, we have packages and so on. But once you're inside Julia, once you're running Julia, then there are only modules. So in principle, one project could contain multiple modules. I don't know whether that's a good idea or not. But in many, many ways, it's the same thing. And for example, the project and the module should have the same name. Okay, if there are no further questions, then next Wednesday I'm going to continue introducing the Julia language. I'm going to go a bit more into the computer science part of it, into the depth of the language, the advanced features of the language that could be interesting. And then on Friday, again, another lab where I'm going to show you something. I forgot what I promised you. And I think four of you want to take the course for credit. I think we should now go to the cafeteria, have a coffee, and then discuss the details of how to do that, or how the credits for the course will work.